Welcome to Nashville to Memphis, a podcast hosted by Dr. Jason Lee McKinney, a recording artist, songwriter, and the rock star professor. N2M is a podcast where Jason and a guest or two literally talk on the phone while Jason is driving down I-40. The only subject criteria is that this podcast is all about the random crap Jason thinks about. So, all of you podcasters and audiophiles, just chill on the sound quality, you dig? Jason is a front pocket theologian, back pocket socio-philosopher, and a jockstrap surveyor of the music industry. You may not be able to make sense of it all, but that's okay. Neither can he. Thanks for listening to Nashville to Memphis. Don't forget to rate and write a review for the podcast on iTunes. You can find it under the title Nashville to Memphis. You can reach the podcast at www.facebook.com/Nashville to Memphis. And check out Jason's music at www.jasonleemckinneyband.com, as well as iTunes and Spotify under Jason Lee McKinney Band.
Welcome back. This week's episode of N2M, I got my hometown on the horn and call my old friend Brett Nicholson. Brett is the head pastor of One Life Network. One Life is the network of church plants. Brett has three kids, one grandbaby, and a saint as a wife. Brett's a bass player, a Beatles fan, C.S. Lewis aficionado, and a really deep-thinking dude. Brett and I chat a little bit about the early Christian church and its history, the pride of Calvinists, and why do humans, no matter what we believe, always think we live in the utopian age of enlightenment, where we got it all figured out. So sit back, buckle up, adjust the rear view. The exits for Centerville and Fairview are just ahead on this week's episode of Nashville to Memphis.
So, yeah, I just wanted to pick your brain about stuff, some theological stuff. So, but first, I need to, like, I'll do, like, some editing. So if you say anything and later on you're like, oh, that was dumb, so take that part out. Can totally do that. I need to do, like, we need to do act like we, you know, we're talking to people and, like I don't know if you do practice runs of sermons, but it's kind of like that. Like, so I'll need to, like, introduce you as if, like, it's going to seem weird because it's like I don't know you, but I do. So,
okay.
So it's that kind of thing. So on the podcast today is Brett Nicholson. And Brett, you are the pastor in Evansville that I know that had the most awesome mullet in the 90s. So fill people in on sans mullet, Brett, what has happened. And so One Life church pastor, but what happened in between the mullet and One Life, and how did One Life start?
In between the mullet, that's the first time I've ever heard that kind of expressed that way, is that's how my life breaks down. But I will use that from now on. It'll be,
it's
like
pre and post mullet.
Pre and post mullet. Post mullet. And once it went away, it was probably kind of the thing that was the catalyst to move me into a whole new territory. So I worked for an older church for several years and had a great time there. And we developed some new things. It was kind of interesting to try to turn that from, from one style of 75-year-old church. And we turned it to kind of a more of a modern feel. And in the process of that, we ended up out of that church planting we have named a network called One Life Network, and we have three churches in Evansville and then also in Henderson, Kentucky, and we are planning on planting more. And our basic concept is that we want to provide a place where people who don't believe these things to interact actively about them. And a lot of people are maybe de-churched or struggle, whether it's intellectually or emotionally, with those things. We want to provide an environment where you can have open discussions and hopefully get some intelligent and gracious answers. And so we've been doing that since 10-10-10 is when we opened up, and still going strong on that. So that's the post-mullet world.
Okay, awesome. And I have a lot of musicians on here. And would you consider yourself still a musician or a former or a recovering musician? There's three different categories.
I don't know. It's always hard to look back and consider myself a musician, period, because I always wanted to be in those ranks, but I never felt like I was good enough to be legit. But maybe that's not fair, because I think I was better than some, and I tried real hard to be good at one point. I played bass and back in the mullet and pre-mullet days. I played a lot of bass, but I think maybe a recovering musician, because I still kind of like to be in there. I like production as much as anything, and I like watching other musicians and telling them what they ought to do better. That's it. I was an observer, you know. It's like, I don't play very well, but I kind of know good playing when I see it. It's kind of
As someone who tours a lot, my favorite guys are the ones that come and go, you know what you ought to do? Those are my favorite guys.
I'm that guy. I don't want to be that guy. And that's what I do as a pastor, is I kind of work with our musicians, and here's what really ought to happen. But I like to think I have at least a background experience to give informed stuff. But I've also noticed that since I'm older, those opinions are becoming much less relevant to anybody that I talk to. So I just kind of keep to myself.
My world is, you know, Americana world, and so my opinion still matters there. But my oldest son is in a touring punk rock band that they have like a screamer and a singer. He plays bass and sings, and they're actually out on tour now. And so I heard their new album, and I was like, I don't really get the screaming thing, man. I don't really understand that whole thing, And so then they released the album on Tuesday. I went on Thursday to see their album release, and there was 350 kids singing all the words back to them. And so afterwards I was like, hey man, I need to apologize. I don't get it, but it's connecting with your age group. And he said, Dad, if you got it, I'd be really worried. Fair enough, man. That's probably true.
Isn't it funny that we're having those conversations we never thought we'd have? Cool you think you're remaining growing older, you're not going to. You can't pull it off. There's things you don't get. And yeah, my son, I got a 17-year-old, and he and his friends listen to stuff that I literally make fun of. So, but they make fun of me to some return. So it's but we all understand each other.
Yeah. So hey, we actually go way back. I was actually a participant in your first marriage. Now I'm not currently in that marriage, but the first marriage you performed. Not you've been married to the same wonderful woman. I said that wrong. So you've been married to the same person. Not your first marriage. Your first marriage you performed.
Right. This is very interesting to listen to. Keep going. I'm find out where I come into this whole thing of your life.
So we go way back. I remember you talked about One Life being a type of place where you want people to ask questions. And I can kind of testify to the fact that I was in a class. I don't know if you remember teaching this, sort of all ages, and it was sort of a come ask your deep, weird theological questions, like why was Goliath 6'9" in the early manuscripts, and then he was 9'8", and come ask that weird question. And there was a guy who came who was at first gave the appearance of truly seeking, but after a number of weeks clearly wasn't really seeking. He was just there to argue. And even at a young age, you handled that with a lot of grace and a lot of mercy and a lot of understanding, where if the guy weren't super yoked and tough, like I would have wanted to punch him, but he would have totally kicked my butt. So you handled it much better than I did.
Yeah, I remember what you're talking about now. Yeah.
So just kind of like you handle those questions with just, you know, yeah, I get it. You know, sometimes it doesn't make sense kind of thing. So that was
probably why I was gracious, though, is the same reason. Yeah, he was kind of a big guy.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, you might as well be nice.
Yeah. At a certain point, you kind of run out of options when he stands up like, hey, buddy, it's cool, man. We're all friends. But,
yeah, that's right. That's right.
So that kind of segues into what I really wanted to dive into and I know that you are, and you actually, I do legitimately listen to your sermons. I legitimately do. You're actually my favorite speaker when it comes to, Tim Keller is amazing content-wise. But every now and then, because of his cadence, I get a little I get a little sleepy listening to him, because he just got that cadence. But you're the one that keeps me entertained as well as providing some good information. So now Tony Evans is pretty entertaining because he's got that whole rhyming thing that the African American church has.
There's no competing with that. The top of the, absolutely.
So, but the church history thing that I know you've really dove into the early church and, you know, the first 400 years. And I wanted to kind of talk about one of the things that sort of always bothered me, got me questioning things is, and I heard this joke that NASA has reported that a Calvinist in Pensacola, Florida, their ego is so big about their theology that it's now visible from space. And so And so I thought that was pretty funny.
That was pretty funny. I had not heard that one. That's good.
So I lean towards Calvinism. I wouldn't consider myself a strict five pointer, but I right. think my thing is, both with, you know, atheists and with Christians, there is a little bit of this mentality of, but now we know. You hear that, like, but now we know that we have, basically, and it's always leading to the fact that, but now we know we have it all figured out. Right. Like, up until, you know, like 2 years ago, we knew that dinosaurs were like lizards, but, oh, now they probably have feathers. Like, and, right. and it's sort of like, instead of going, an atheist going, oh, well, maybe we don't know everything about evolution. Like, they go, oh, but now we got it. Now we got it. And the same thing right. happens in Christendom. Whatever our theological beliefs are, and I don't think that the Bible changes. I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying our understanding of, you know, the whole rule of thumb, like, you know, you can beat your wife, but only with a stick this big, and kind of thing. Like, obviously, the Bible never condones or teaches that. But there was a time in the church when that was sort of accepted, as gross as that is, or slavery was accepted, and good Christian people owning slaves. And so my overall question is, I wanted to discuss with you today, like, sort of the changes, the theological changes and the movements within the church, and then sort of like, what have you found back to the early church that it's like, oh, that belief, and I know that there's the core tenets, obviously, and I'm not talking about stuff like, you know, Jesus is Lord and he's the Son of God, but what are the core tenets, sort of the secondary tenets that sort of stayed and have been sort of like surprisingly encouraging that has been consistent through the church? And then what are the ones that are going, okay, these have ebbed and flowed and moved. And so I know it's sort of a broad question and we can rabbit trail as much as you want, but that's sort of what I wanted to dive into, if that's a cool subject for you. I figure it's something you're interested in. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And that makes you officially the first person that has asked me anything about early church history that I've got it. So yeah, this is great. In the way the question is, but I got to process that a little bit on the fly because, as far as movements go, I mean, one comment you made about, you know, everything from slavery, I was just reading an article, within the last couple of days about the early church's view of slavery. And, you know, we always have to, a line I like to use is, a proud Christian is an oxymoron. You can't, theoretically, I know Calvinist, the whole space from space thing is pretty funny, but to me, that's not really visiting in on where you really are talking from, because to express a Christian theology, as it were, in some kind of spirit of pride is to miss the point of Christian theology. It doesn't fit with what you're doing, because, you know, for obvious reasons, you are someone who literally needed to be transformed, or you would have just on your own devices, you would have not fared well before God. And so looking back, especially to some of those early people, you always have to remember you're kind of trapped inside your own cultural leanings, your own cultural issues and assumptions and problems and challenges. And there were early revolutionary voices on the slavery question. But it was so much a part of the fabric of their reality that they had known for centuries that one guy commented, there wasn't even a thought of trying to abolish it, because they couldn't even get there in their imagination. It was too much. However, they did know the roots of the dignity of man. They started preaching that, and they started preaching things like, if you do have slaves, you better treat them well, or, you know, you, because you're a servant before God. That's in the New Testament, but it's also in the early church. In the early church histories, they would end up, they said, there were lots of reports about how former masters, the slaves, they would end up being friends instead of master and slave. And oftentimes, what they ended up doing over that first few hundred years, they would have full ceremonies in churches where a master would set a slave free. And so they didn't try to get the institution overtaken legally for quite a while. But on the other hand, just in the back and forth of life, there was a lot of revolutionary action that was happening just on personal levels. where people were starting to sit down right next to their slaves. There was one slave that went all the way to the top of the church as a bishop. It was a great equalizer. And so what impressed me, I guess, with what has stayed in its truest form is the transforming power of how people look at the world when they come to Christ. If they really come to him, they start seeing other people differently. They start, their values starts radically changing in how they process what it really matters versus what doesn't, and how I see my social status and those kinds of things. That's been one of the most encouraging. The power that they put on loving others that they hadn't loved before. Roman culture especially was very class-based. You didn't associate with people that weren't in your particular, socioeconomic strata there. But they started breaking those barriers like crazy and very intentionally. And that wasn't a law passed. That was just kind of how they started living. And it really did disrupt the thing. So that has been one of the most encouraging things of all. You just see people living out the love of Christ.
Right. Are you hoping to bring that change between the East and West Side in Evansville? Because there's definitely a class system.
Yeah, there definitely is. Yeah, that's right. I think it's over my head. That's why we literally planted a church in the West and a church in the East. Yeah, that's we figured you can't do that. So we just
gave
they're
not
in.
Crossing those lines, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. We just gave in. We just kind of went with it, and we'll have to try another way or something like that, yeah.
So has there been any, like, surprising things you found that the church has transformed over the years and, like, because I know, and excuse, I've forgotten who it is, but even the way we do church in modern America, wasn't that sort of like not even a thing until a Presbyterian minister in the 1800s or something? And I know you're studying, but just what has been something surprising that you found? Even if it's super encouraging, that'd be awesome.
Well, if it's super encouraging, I don't know if it's super encouraging or not. Well, the most surprising thing I found was how Catholic it was, which is an anathema statement to a lot of people. But the early church, what I'm seeing, and again, my kind of backing up just a little bit here, I'm just a history nerd anyway, and so I love the process of reading history, and so the New Testament is part of an historical era, and what I decided to do was just keep traveling with it through, especially the pre-Nicene era, so the first 400 years. And so and there's a lots of documents. I mean, the primary documents, you can read letters that were written in 110 AD or 150 or 180 or 210. And so what you see traveling, what really surprised me was how wonderfully and beautifully unified. And when I say Catholic, what I mean, first of all, is a little bit of the formalism that we would probably be unfamiliar with, especially being Protestants. They had liturgies. They had a common practice. One historian walked you through what a typical church service would have looked like in 200 AD. And if you went, and it was structured around, I love, one of the things we're going to start doing in our own church. They said they opened the service by addressing unbelievers. And they would explain the gospel to unbelievers and welcome them there. And then they would say, here's what's going to be happening the rest of the service and how you relate to it. They would walk them through that, preach the gospel to them and say, here's how you become a Christian if you so choose. And then they would address different groups. They had what they call pre-catechumens, and then they had the people who were going through the catechism, and then they had those who had been baptized, and they addressed them differently, and they would ask everybody to leave, and only the baptized could come in and have communion. And so on one hand, that sounds kind of weird, but on the other hand, especially in the modern era, to me, it was very refreshing. And one of my attractions to that era is I think we're in a time of the world that's more like the Roman Empire than it was like the Protestant Reformation. The Protestant Reformation happened in the context of a Christianized world. The early church was in a non-Christianized world, and I think that's where we are. And so I find it fascinating how they handled that. But you would go, and you would do liturgies, and you would do prayers, and there was a bishop, and there were presbyters, and there were so that, for me, it was surprising, because I thought the early church was less formal, but they actually were more. And because they were very, very, very tight about those crowning doctrines, and they wanted to make sure that people got it. Because most people, you know, obviously couldn't read, you know, you can walk out with a Bible in your hand. So they wanted to make sure you heard that Apostles' Creed, and make sure you heard the book of 1 Corinthians and the book of 1 Samuel or whatever. And so they build it in, and they were very careful about that kind of stuff. So I thought that was very cool, and that's how the things passed on so well.
Hey, guys, thank you so much for taking just a little bit of your time to listen to Nashville to Memphis. This is truly a passion project for me. But like everything else in the world, it does cost money to do. So if you listen to this and you enjoy it and you find any value in it at all, I would really appreciate if you go over to www.jasonleemckinneyband.com or find Jason Lee McKinney Band on iTunes. Download a song or two. Every few bit of dollars helps me to pay for this, helps me to pay for other things. Or go on over to Spotify and follow the band, give it a few streams. That also helps, though, as we all know, not quite as much. So if you can do that, that would help me to be able to keep going, to be able to justify to my lovely wife to keep spending the money on this podcast. And it would go a long way. Even a couple dollars goes a long way. And share with your friends about the podcast. And if you enjoy the music, share with your friends about the band, too. All right, guys, thank you so much. Now back to the show.
It's funny because not funny, haha, funny, but My other son, Zion, is a worship pastor in Kansas City. And his whole group of people, and it's not just him, it's sort of nationwide. There is a real move in young college age, slightly post-college Christians back to the liturgical. Like it's right. And it's really, I think, refreshing, and you know, society's always this pendulum thing. Humans can never really get things right. It's like we're going to go too far this way, and then we're going to swing back, and now we're going to go too far the other way. And I almost think church has gotten too familiar, too easy, too even worship lyrics are God is awesome, God is awesome, God is awesome, God is awesome. It's like, okay, yes, but where is the, you know, saved a wretch like me? Where's the I suck and God is awesome? Like I missed that part of life. He saved me from something, you know, and there's this move of a return to the liturgical. And I think it's great. I think it's refreshing. And I think it could, I'm not speaking this prophetically because I'm not that guy. I don't have that gift, but I'm saying I could see it being sort of a mini revival. And I think that could be good. What would you see as the benefits of a slight return to the liturgical?
Well, I think it's for me, what I coach our team on is I want us, and I think we should be, radically progressive in everything from technology to art and all that, and it is any area that we can be. We ought to be the most free thinking people you can possibly meet and express ourselves that way, but at the same exact time be radically ancient. And because the Christian worldview is the only one that has a basis for doing any of those things. And for me, the liturgy, again, it's got to be good liturgy. That can be good liturgy, bad liturgy. But the good liturgy from that era, because they were living in a non-Christianized world, they had to be a lot more sure and understanding about their belief system and how it compared to all the other belief systems that were out there. And so to me, the liturgy is about the Christian statement of reality has to be stated and differentiated from all the other belief systems, because otherwise it'll get lost. And what we've lived in and what we grew up with is a Christian assumption in the background all the time. Well, that's not true anymore. We don't have those assumptions. Well, they didn't have those assumptions back then. They had to state it. We believe in God the Father, maker of heaven and earth. They had to say that because the very next door temple believed the exact opposite. And so I think it's good because it gives you your Christian distinctives. The Christian worldview is amazing and wonderful and answers all the questions of life, in my opinion. And so stating it formally and hearing yourself state it out loud and then getting that ingrained in you, no, I think it's very refreshing. And I think it's going to be more needed the more complex and technologically advanced and complicated our lives get. Because, I mean, we're dealing in an age where they're going to be, you know, you're going to have bionic parts in your brain, you know. So we better know what we believe. Like the early church, who I was impressed with, they had really meaty philosophical discussions. And they discussed real beliefs. We tend to discuss, you know, actions or, I don't know, just kind of different cultural things. They were talking about when they had to get into that Trinity stuff, they were very schooled philosophically, and they had to really, really dig down into how does our belief system compare with all these others. And but that's what made them distinct, and that's what made them free as well. So, and I think we're going to need that big time, or Christianity will get drowned out with all the stuff that's going on out there.
So
I'm glad it's happening.
Do you think, and I've heard it put, have we officially in the United States, you know, there's always the thing where we're, some people say 20, some people say 30 years behind Europe culturally, and whatever happens there will happen here in 30 years. And it's pretty widely known that they have moved completely into a post-Christian society. Not that there aren't Christians in Europe. I'm not saying that, but
in general,
it is not the predominant. You find empty churches everywhere, beautiful cathedrals that are just they're just buildings now. Has the United States, have we moved to that point? Have we gotten to that point where do you think it's official that we're in a post-Christian society?
Not in the same way that, you know, they went from what was labeled as Christendom to a very radical form of a post-Christian world. The United States, I think, because of the immigration from all over the world, and expressions, New York's a microcosm of this, and spending more time there, you get a whole lot of ethnic groups. And what we don't realize is that people from South America, people out of Asia, are first generation Christian, and they're coming into our, so we're experiencing a little bit more of a blend than Europe is. Europe experienced the immigration thing, and they'll get some of it there. But the United States, because of its rich, fertile soil and its Christian past, it's still pretty recent and hasn't had all the wars and some of the things that the Europeans dealt with. I think you're going to have a post-Christian, but it's a very different expression. It's almost like some people are adjusting over to one person called it a therapeutic deism kind of look at life. It's not raw humanism. It's not raw atheism. It's just sort of, you know, redefining the Christian God as sort of, you know, kind of a nice therapist in the sky kind of stuff. And then at the same time, it's getting infused with all this, you know, active Christianity coming out of Asia and South America. So we're experiencing it, but it's very different in many respects. Now, of course, when it comes to the educated corners, like, you know, Ivy League schools and all that, you get a very kind of tracking with Europe. But I guess to me, it looks like it's expressing itself a lot different. And I don't know if it'll ever be quite the way Europe is, in my observation. Europe's gotten pretty dark and cold. I think the United States will always have some of the lively flickers of Christian and who knows what else, other religions going on all the time. Just because of the nature of our society, almost.
Yeah, and that leads to, there's the, you know, people, kind of was a buzzword for a while, cultural Christianity and all that sort of, you know, how do you, and this is probably going to be a difficult question, I'm going to try to answer it or ask it as concisely as possible. There's always that rub of when someone says they believe in Jesus, do they believe, like, grandma told me to believe in Jesus? Or, like, do you believe in the actual guy who claims to be God? Because his claims are still today pretty radical, and they're pretty exclusive. People talk about, you know, inclusiveness in America and coexist, but at the end of the day, Jesus's claims are fairly exclusive. And is that just by the nature going to end up forcing people to make some sort of line in the sand decision? And then the second part of that, is that good? If it does that, is that good? Because I feel like the United States is sort of skated by on this, especially in the South, that, like, oh, of course I believe in Jesus. I'm going to go do whatever I want, but I believe in Jesus. You know, like,
right.
So is that sort of, because of the coexist, because of the whole movement towards tolerance, which really tolerance isn't even the right word, it's acceptance. I mean, tolerance has come to mean complete and total acceptance. Is that line in the sand going to force people to make that decision, to decide in a gracious, loving way, but in a way that's probably going to end up in opposition? Like, no, this is the side of the line I stand on.
Yeah. Yeah, as far as I understand, I think the Lion, the Stand thing will come more and more because, and the stats, as I understand them, is what's happening in our culture is that nominal Christianity is going away. As Stetzer, I think, said that for the first time in American history over about the last 10 years, it's not sociologically beneficial for you to call yourself a Christian in most places. And that's becoming, in the South, it's still probably true. He's a good church-going guy. He's a good Christian guy. That's going away. Actually now, especially in places like on the East and West Coast, to be a Christian, especially you get labeled an evangelical Christian, that's socially disadvantageous. I mean, so that's already happened in a circle, certain circles. So that line in the sand thing is going to have to happen. It is happening in some way. And so because before cultural Christianity just kind of worked for everybody because it was, it was something that was a benefit, but the line of stand thing, if you really are serious about your faith, you can't help it. I mean, I can look at the worldview that I'm being presented as a part of my culture, and I can watch how it's lived out. And if I'm going to be honest about my faith, of course there's going to be things that just run against the grain of everything I'm being told. They just do. And for me, it's a matter of authenticity. If I really do say I believe this stuff, it does. Of course it runs up against it. Now I still probably won't be throwing the lions or anything, but I will swim against the stream. I have to. There's no
run
because some of these is basically contradictory. You just they can't coincide logically or honestly. If that's what you're getting to, I hope I this kind of thing, the implications of my beliefs. Now I think we ought to flip it too though. And this is the struggle within secularism. Secularism also is struggling with the implications of its own beliefs, because secularism is tied to philosophical naturalism or materialism and wants to hang on to a lot of truly Christian ideals like compassion and those kinds of things, but it doesn't have a basis to it. So that's the internal secular struggle that's going on around about people who are thinking about these things. Some people say, well, you can keep all these nice Christian ideas that you want, but they don't have a basis in naturalism. They don't. Most of these ideas that we take for granted, they come from Christianity, whether anybody likes them or not.
Right. It's funny because – not funny, huh? I keep saying funny. I don't know why. I don't do it on most podcasts. But now I'm all of a sudden Joe Pesci. You funny, ha-ha funny? Or
the, right. Pick it up on that, yeah.
But for me – and maybe I've always thought, well, maybe I'm just an awful person, but it's like, just the whole concept of being faithful to my wife, if it's purely naturalism, I want to sleep with a lot of women. I want to, my natural self. I would find no reason not to do that. And I say, if I'm just like my dog, when she's in heat, will pretty much accept any male dog that there is. Reason I don't is because I do believe that while I am purely an animal physically, I do have the nature of the creator in me, and I am called to not do that. And I am called to love a woman faithfully. So I don't do it. And I've heard people say, well, I'm just a better guy than that. It's like, are you though? Like, is it really just society? Like, is it, I know you mentioned this. I remember from a sermon, but it also struck me that whole Anne Hathaway part in Interstellar. Like, it doesn't make any sense for me to go to this planet, but I love him. And humans are the ones that we don't, my mom's kind of getting old. I'm not throwing her out on the trash heap and saying, well, she doesn't serve a purpose anymore. Let's just get rid of her. Like, no, it's my mom. I'm going to take care of her when it's convenient, when it's not convenient. And so I see that humanism, that secularism failing in that because I don't know if people are really willing to be honest about their depravity. Like, I see a woman every day that I would want to sleep with, or I would want to get hammered every night and drunk. It's fun. To a certain point, it's fun. I don't do that because I'm called not to do that. But
yeah, and some would say, well, you're just being a bad person. But it really is. It's kind of a thing you throw in. You get Sam Harris's or Derek Coyne's of the world, who are naturalists, who also actually try to logically argue that we don't even have free will anyway. So you could, and that gets in, that takes you down quite a hole there, because then you can blame any kind of behavior on how your cells are moving around in your head. And so that introduces all kinds of problematic struggles that, I think it was Nietzsche who said that we live in the shadow of the Buddha, and meaning that the belief in Christianity went away a long time ago, but the shadow, people still live as if it's true. They would deny it kind of fundamentally, but they still live as if, you know, all these things that Christianity really did introduce to the world are still real, and they're not. And that's why he was arguing that, no, we need to go with power. We need to go with the ancient, the ethic of power to the strong, that kind of stuff. And we've got to make a choice. But that's where humanism is going to start struggling. But that, and going back to that line in the sand thing, I think we Christians have a wonderful line to draw, because we can say we have a basis. We have a basis for compassion, a basis for honor, a basis for love, a basis for sacrifice, a basis for everything. Whereas all this stuff that's being said in our modern culture, pulling away God, pulling away all things spiritual, well, you've pulled away more than just that. You've pulled away love and sacrifice and all those things that we care about to make us human.
Right. All right, so a couple final questions. One of them, kind of on this topic, and then I'm going to go completely off the topic, just something silly.
Okay, good. Thanks for the heads up.
So arguments about, like, you know, annihilationism versus eternal hell, or, like, you know, one of our favorite guys, C.S. Lewis, believed in a purgatory versus not purgatory, or even down to Arminianism versus Calvinism. Do those... You know, those things throughout church history have been argued and argued and argued. And one can make the case that they really haven't helped the cause of Christianity. But there are people who feel so strongly, like, I know people who are Calvinists who will call Wesleyans heretics, and which I think is a very dangerous statement to make. But is, you know, people say, well, as long as we agree on the basics, but the problem is, we don't agree on what the basics are. So those sort of arguments, as society moves away from Christendom, will they become less – do you feel – and I realize totally you're going to speculate and you're predicting, and no one will hold you accountable to this. So no one hold Brett accountable. He's not a statement. So yeah, do you feel like those things will fall away as we're more pressed to be bold for what actually does matter? That there is a creator who loves us, that there is Jesus, or will they continue to be a source of malcontent between Christians?
Will those things fade away? I don't think they'll fade away in the internal of the church world. However, here's, you mentioned C.S. Lewis, you mentioned Tim Keller a while back. Here's what I've noticed, that, and Tim Keller is a very good example of this. I've noticed, and he's a Reformed, had been Professor Winchester. I mean, he's a Reformed guy, five-pointer, the whole nine yards, named Calvin, that does that whole thing. However, he does active mission church planting in New York City among some of the most secular people in the world. He's, you know, Columbia University students are in his. And what he does and we've been to his training and all this kind of thing, what he does in those contexts, in the mission context, He's not afraid to say that he believes those things, but he makes them very much kind of a second place. He quotes a lot of C.S. Lewis. He does, when you're doing raw mission on the streets and you're doing apologetics in the real world with real people, you don't put those things at the front of what you're arguing. You never do. You do instinctively. You know that the real core basics, you do instinctively. You do talk about the atonement. You talk about the resurrection. You talk about the person of Christ. You talk about fully God, fully man. All these big orthodox ideas that, incidentally, the early church did major in. Those are the things you put in the front of the line, and those things that often are, you know, kind of secondary internal debates. They do fall by the wayside, because when you're dealing with people who literally don't believe this stuff at all in a secular environment, it just naturally happens. And I do believe more and more Christians are going to be finding that dear Christianity thing is just a necessity. Otherwise, you're not going to make any, you're not going to take any ground at all. You're just not. And most people that know that, they're active missionally. So I always have a lot of respect for those who would call themselves Calvinists, but they're having coffee shop conversations with people who are naturalists.
Right.
Those are the debates they ought to be having, and they tend to know how to carry their beliefs better than people who, you know, one Calvinist talking to another Calvinist or arguing with an Arminian.
Right.
You know, you want a real argument, you know, that'll shape you. You know, you need to talk to somebody who doesn't believe this stuff or is a Hindu or something like that, because it defines your worldview a lot differently. So my prediction will be, yeah, as our society becomes more secular, the more missional thinking Christians will let that stuff have its own place, and they'll chill out over a lot of those things increasingly. But they'll start majoring in the major doctrines and embracing the Christian worldview as it distinguishes itself from secularism and naturalism and the new spiritualism and all that.
Awesome. All right, so let's shift gears. So two final questions. You are the desert island question, but it's with books.
Oh, dear.
So
okay, well, yeah.
So you can't take your Bible. Someone says there's no Bible, but there's three other books. You can only take three books. What would they be?
Oh, that would be Orthodoxy by G.K. Chesterton. I think probably Eusebius Ecclesiastical History. That one's just a blast. I love that one. It's a lot of fun. Boy, the third one. I didn't thought of that. It probably would be a Lewis thing. I want to make sure I don't speak to – boy, the third one's hard. Or
a Grief Observed. That's uplifting.
Yeah, that's right. That's got me stuck. I love The Soul of Science by Nancy Piercy, of all things. But I don't know if I could read it just on a desert island over and over and over again. It would probably be one of the early church fathers or something, like a First Clement or something like that, just because it's getting close to the New Testament that kind of restates it. But that if I had something I had to repeat read over and over and over again.
That's
so, but
awesome.
Definitely, especially Orthodox, I reread that one fairly regularly because it's just fun. I love it.
All right, so last question now. This is the most important question. This one might make you sweat a little bit.
Oh, dude, the most important one is going to make you sweat the most?
Yeah.
Jeez, man, there's a setup.
So everyone has songs that they're a little ashamed to admit they like. And you rock out to in the shower, but if people are around, you're like, no, I hate that too. That's terrible. That song's awful. So it could be, you know, Come and Get Your Love from Redbone. I mean, they were the only Native American band ever hit the number one slot.
There's a piece of stuff. Okay.
So what is your guilty pleasure, the song that you've always loved but maybe never, ever confessed it publicly?
Wow, that is an interesting question. I've been to two Taylor Swift concerts, and I took my girls, but I actually enjoyed it. I'm thinking, but there's got one that I wouldn't confess publicly. Man. Boy, I wish I would have got an advance notice on that one, because I know they're there. Because first of all, I think most people would make fun of stuff that I like. I love the first Black Sabbath album. This is one of my favorite albums ever. And I'm not sure how many circles you can admit that in.
Right.
Especially doing what I do for a living. I'm caught. I'm sorry. I'm trying to fish. It's not that I don't have them. I'm trying to fish around for...
I mean, it could be Rick Springfield. It could be Leo Sayer.
Yeah.
That's when he needs you.
Yeah. There's all kinds of stuff out there to choose from that I'm quite sure.
Brandy, you're a fine girl. if you can't think of one, it's okay. But it's entertaining when people do.
Yeah, it really is. I'm failing. All these things are rushing across my head from, and I know they're there. I'll probably think of it later, but it's not coming to me. It's not coming in
that
flash.
That's okay.
I remember Ballroom Blitz. Would that count? I remember I loved that as a kid, and I still do, I think. That one might be one. I'm not pulling anything that was that would be too entertaining, I don't think.
Too super embarrassing. Other than your love of Rush. But
I am absolutely Rush geek, and more so now than ever. I'm kind of, it's resurging in my life as I'm watching them kind of, you know, ride off in the sunset. I'm like having all these, I'm more radically Rush fan than I ever was.
So, to wrap it up, thanks for doing this, man. First of all, I appreciate it taking a little time. And I do have one complaint about your sermons. So you ready for some critique?
Sure, absolutely. It happens all the time anyway.
Is it Jeff Braun makes a sermon, but I don't? I mean, you didn't mention him by name, but I knew who you're talking about. So Jeff Braun is in a sermon, but I can't in a sermon? So.
Oh, I think you have been probably several ways since I'm not naming. I mean, you've probably been the antagonist in a million. And it's kind of like sort
I'm the
of
bad guy.
Assumed guy that's out there that I knew a guy once that won't play, that kind of stuff. No, I'll work on it. I think you have been, though, literally, though. I could probably say that thing about, you know, your whole first wedding thing you did with me at the opening of this little talk.
You
use that. Like, okay, and that obviously went well. Yeah. So you probably should do that. But, I appreciate the opportunity.
Now that we have dismantled the atomic bomb, go check out Brett's church at onelifechurch.org. See you next week.